This is what happens when you try and get your money out of an ATM, but the bank won't let you. Or you're waiting in a long line with many other people, again, trying to get your money out of the bank. These are daily scenes from Lebanon on the brink. Hi, I'm Femi OK, and you're watching The Stream. Today, we're going to ask, is Lebanon, is there hope for some kind of change for Lebanon, a country that right now is bankrupt, doesn't have a president, and no functioning government? There is so much to talk about. You can join us live on YouTube in the comment section right here.
Lebanese lira's depreciated by 95% in the past 3 years. The minimum wage dropped from $450 per month to $50 per month. Now there's a cholera outbreak with more than 1,000 cases, whereas 40% of the medical staff have emigrated. Lebanese banks are still holding depositors' money. And depositors are conducting heists in order to get their own money back, just like Casa de Papel. The people hold all of them accountable. The ruling class, who still don't have an economic plan to get out of the situation of the crisis. The central bank, the banks, the militias, who are still protecting and covering the regime and the system. For the good or the bad, the Lebanese people are still resilient. They still hold on to the little hope they have. Some of the youth feel a necessity to create hope in order to create a better future for them in Lebanon.
Whew. So much going on in Lebanon, so much not going on in Lebanon, right? So how do we have this conversation? Well, we have it with Aliyah, we have it with Habib, and also with Hussein. Thank you, all three of you, for being on the stream. Aliyah, first of all, will you tell us who you are, what you do?
I'm Aliyah Ibrahim. I am a journalist, co-founder of an independent media based in Beirut named Daraj. Mostly we work on investigative journalism.
Good to have
and
you.
And basically, we unfollowed the money, yeah. All right. Thank you. Good to be here.
Hello, Habib. Welcome back to the stream. Good to have you. Remind our audience who you are and what you do.
I'm Habib Attah. I'm an investigative independent journalist, and I've been reporting on Lebanon for the last 20 years or so.
And Hussein, say hello to our audience around the world.
Hi, my name is Hussein Shaito. I'm a development economist here in Beirut at a think tank called the Policy Initiative and a fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. I'm happy to be here.
Good to have you. Habib, I'm going to take our viewers through the last few months, starting in April, but I know that you have been reporting and telling stories about Lebanon for many years. So I'm going to start in April, then you can tell me what I missed out. Not everything, but some key points as to how we got here. So in April, in Lebanon, the IMF agreed to a $3 billion loan, but with conditions. Then in May, election results spur hope for change. I remember us doing a show about, this is exciting, possibilities for Lebanon. In July, amid the financial crisis, the UN warns Lebanon that they're at a crossroads between rebound or collapse. And then bringing us right up to date, Lebanon right now has no president or a fully functioning government. Did I leave out anything truly critical for us to have this conversation today, Habib?
Well, I think that people should understand that Lebanon is not a very peaceful, stable country. And, you know, last year we had gun battles in the streets in Lebanon last October. So I think it's important to remember that there is an actual conflict happening in this country, and it's at war with itself. And it's a proxy battlefield. You know, we have the biggest party bloc in parliament that's backed by the Saudis. We have, you know, the United States is basically funding the Lebanese military completely right now. And France is always playing a role in Lebanon. Iran is playing a major role in Lebanon, funding Hezbollah to the tune of several hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. So it is, you know, we can focus on the internal politics of Lebanon, but we can't forget about the fact that these proxies, these parties, these militias have for decades been funded by outside powers that continue to sow a divisive environment that is beneficial to these countries' interests.
Hussein, go ahead. What are you thinking?
I definitely agree. I think there's a lot of polarization in the Lebanese, you know, political system driven by, you know, international pressures, etc. But I think I would like to also highlight that, you know, at the end of the day, the crisis we're in and the shocks that the economy is going through is really the result of a political crisis and an institutional crisis that has not been addressed for the past three decades at least. So we're talking about endemic corruption festering public institutions. We're talking about distortions in the economy spearheaded by the political class, preventing any capacity or space for, you know, economic growth or investment in various economic sectors. So in a sense, the political class, the same political class and the same political structure Habib was just talking about, has entrapped society in a vicious cycle where they are always in need of, you know, support, financial support from international community and otherwise.
Right. Propped up by the international community. I'm just having a look here at a headline, which is just from a few hours ago, Alia. Lebanon's parliament fails to elect president in fifth electoral session. How long is it going to take to get a president? That would be a good start, wouldn't it?
Actually, if you know, I would agree largely with Hussein and Habib that there is a political crisis. The thing is, political crises are not new in Lebanon. You're asking me about president. The last time we elected the president, we had 20 years of presidential vacuum before President Aoun was elected. If you look at, this is not to undermine how important a crippled political life is, but this is to say that crippled politics in Lebanon is not new. Since 2005, we've had one third of the time we were functioning on caretaker governments. Right now, we have a caretaker government and we have no president. So basically, the government's institution, let alone the judiciary, is not very functional. There are big question marks there. The big institutions in the country are largely it's not just a presidential vacuum. It's really a failed state. We see that. We live that every day. What worries me, as I'm listening to my colleagues, what worries me as someone who has covered politics and the very complicated political scene in Lebanon for the last 20 years, what's really new is what this economic crisis is going to mean for future generations in Lebanon. What we're seeing now, even the IMF's $3 billion, we cannot reverse the damage that has happened over the last 3 years since 2019, and that is happening every day. I look at, of course, there is the struggles and the depression of the Lebanese people who have to suffer to get basics, electricity, garbage collection. These things you can...
I'm going to pause for a moment, because we often, when we talk about Lebanon, we get sucked into the politics and it gets very secular because we talk about politicians and then there's a vacuum and talk about more politicians. But I want to talk about people who don't have electricity right now. Tell us the reality of what it is like. How many hours a day? What do people spend their time doing? Because I think this is the bit where we would say, as an international community, why is this being allowed to go on? Tell us about real life.
This is, as far like the way I'm telling you, the way I see it, this is really the heart of the problem, because we've normalized, even that has become normalized in Lebanon. We have 0 hours of electricity. Everybody is depending on private generators. People who cannot afford private generators don't have electricity. It's as simple as that. What it ends up meaning, I'll give you an example. Over the last couple, I'm reading on your screen, why are refugees, Syrians, Palestinians, and even Lebanese citizens leaving Lebanon to become refugees in Europe? I'll give you a very simple example from Tripoli. Over the last summer, we've had two boats drowning in Lebanese waters of people who are trying to escape. This is what happens when you don't have the basics. These people, I was told that they were told before boarding on those boats that they have an 80% possibility of drowning. So people are taking that 20% possibility of surviving and making it to Europe. And they are taking kids with them on those boats. That's because the survival rate for them, some categories of people, is zero.
Right. So basically, rather risk your life than stay at home. All right, I hear you. Something that has broken through into international headlines are people going to the bank and getting their own money out in a very dramatic way because they cannot get their money any other way. I want to show you what one journalist witnessed at a bank. And then, Habib, will you bounce off the back of it? Because I'm wondering, how much more can Lebanese people take? They're resilient, but how much more?
I'm inside Ankh in Beirut. This is Ali. He says that the bank is refusing to give him his money back and he needs it. He tried to sell one of his kidneys. That's how desperate he is. But because of the economic crisis here, the bank has stopped people from withdrawing their dollars. And so there are many people who are resorting to desperate measures, taking matters into their own hands. Other people in here demand the money back. There's another man over there in a wheelchair. We are now stuck inside.
That was Hind Hassan, and she says they're desperate measures. What is after desperate measures, Habib?
There have been over a dozen bank heists. We're not calling them robberies because people are actually demanding their own money. The banks in Lebanon are not giving people their money. People are trying to live without money. It's really hard to do that. People are given a very small amount of their money. The banks have been frozen. And the banks are not held accountable in Lebanon, frankly. The banks in Lebanon are refusing to give people their money. They're refusing to accept responsibility for the crisis. And, you know, even world powers are not really weighing in here. You know, the bankers in Lebanon have been for decades seen as great heroes. And many financial industry publications, the Central Bank Governor of Lebanon won Best Banker of the Year for years. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have been deeply involved in Lebanon all these years. So it's a bit surprising now to kind of say that, well, to wash your hands and to say this just happened suddenly, the country is corrupt, when the big international community and the international organizations have really been protecting this banking class in the country. And there's been no sanctions issued against them. The United States has issued sanctions against many Lebanese politicians over corruption, but they have refused to issue any sanctions over the head of Lebanon's central bank, who has been very close to the West. So once again, we can talk about morality and corruption, but it depends on, you know, whose eyes, right? I mean, so that's kind of the fundamental conflict in Lebanon, is how can we get our money? It's very worrying for everybody. People can't get their money. I'm worried about my mom, for example, going to the bank to get her paycheck, if she's going to be part of a holdup. And so far, no one has been hurt, but there are guns being used. Yeah. There are threats to burn buildings down. There are explosive devices. It is not just fun, pulp fiction. A lot of media seem to, you know, relish the idea of a sensational story about someone holding up a bank. It's not a fun
dramatic
story or heroic story.
It's dramatic.
It's a desperate story.
It's incredibly painful.
It's a desperate story.
Hussein, go ahead.
Desperate and painful. I want to jump in.
Yeah, Hussein.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in, and I 100% agree, but I also want to say that the banking sector in Lebanon, alongside the political class, have made a conscious effort at, you know, non-reform, not conducting any reforms. They have been given a laundry list of reforms by the International Monetary Fund, one of which is the banking, you know, lifting banking secrecy, which kind of have protected the banking class from, you know, siphoning funds and tax evasion, and there is also a capital control law, which can kind of stop the drainage of public funds. So there are reforms, there are ways out of crisis that have been, you know, suggested to the political class and the banking sector, and they have made a conscious effort not to pursue those.
All right, Hussein, can I show you something first, and then Habib, and then Alia. So let me show you something here on my laptop. This is the army training for future bank heists. This is the reaction. Sniper outside the bank, approaching the bank, army. These are people trying to get their money, their own money, out of the bank. All right, so that's one that's one reaction. Habib, you're going to go ahead, and what were you going to add?
I mean, you know, the talk about reforms, I think we have to take it more seriously and ask what kind of reforms. And a lot of these international, you know, lending programs involve austerity measures. And a country that's on its knees, people can't afford water, can't afford electricity. Can they be subject to more austerity and cost-cutting measures? Would that help the country? A lot of Lebanese say the IMF has not helped a lot of countries before. And the World Bank has a very, you know, checkered history there when it comes to development. So, you know, how can we really expect that, you know, reforms are going to save us if they're going to actually, you know, cut budgets? What we need in Lebanon is a bigger budget. We need to have a big budget to create jobs, to create an economy. That's how countries work. So Lebanon's fundamental problem, at the end of the day, whether we talk about politics for hours or not, is that the country makes no money. The country cannot generate any revenue. The country makes no products. The country has no manufacturing industry. The country's industry in Lebanon is war. All of our life for 100 years in Lebanon, we've lived war every decade. So no investor wants to invest in this country. So what people can do to help Lebanon, if the international community really wants to help Lebanon, instead of picking and choosing which sides suit its interests and keeping the battle going, they could try to invest money in the country, right? Create projects, help people, and not just aid projects, right, that are just handouts, but actually to create economic growth in the country. That's what it needs. Any country in the world cannot function without an economy, and Lebanon has zero economy today.
All right, Alia, go ahead.
Yeah, and I do agree. I just want to add.
I'll pick it up from there. And I think there's something completely absurd of asking the same political establishment that is responsible for the crisis, which, by the way, is a crisis that is largely related to corruption, to be involved in reform. That for this political class, in the best case scenario, it will limit how corrupt they can be, how much they can control the assets of the government and the resources of the government and use it for clientelism and to stay in power, which we don't see happening. Most importantly, if there are actual reform, many of these people in the political establishment could end up in prison. So I really don't see how an establishment that has been in power for 30 years, that is responsible in every way for the situation we're in, could be informed, could be in charge of actual reform. And this is a decision by the international community. Let's assume that happens. We were talking earlier about the banks. Regardless of where you stand, what kind of political economy you want in Lebanon, what happened at the bank is not an issue of left or right. There was literally people's money, people's deposits were stolen by the banks. People don't have, and there isn't even an official capital control. Now, you're asking us about the bank, and this is an international show. You will not have this conversation on the Lebanese media. A report showed us, for example, that during the crisis, and in the few months earlier, since 2016, $1.7 billion were invested by the banks and by the central bank to the local media to make sure that stories like that are never discussed on mainstream media. This can tell you what's happening at the level of the public opinion. There's so much information about people's rights that they are not even aware of. Now, the other thing is, in Parliament, for example, the reforms that were suggested by the IMF, let's again assume that these reforms are going to take place. The strongest defenders of the banks inside and very openly, inside Parliament, the parliamentarians from different groups, opposing each other, are all defending the banks.
All right. So from our audience. They want to talk to you. They want to tap into your expertise. So Robbie says solutions, ? Joseph says, I would like to hear a solution. Hussein, and then Habib,
yeah,
and then Alia. Because you are inside of Lebanon, you see what is happening for particular perspectives. What do you want to add for our audience? Saying, well, what do you do now? The same you start.
For sure. I think as I just want to kind of like build on what I was mentioning earlier. The IMF reforms, of course, there's a track record, a history of, failed IMF, deals across the world. However, there are some basic reforms that any government in the situation of Lebanon should be conducting. So, such as a capital control law, which is one solution. And there is also the restructuring of the banking sector to ensure that the majority of society does not continue to bear the brunt of the crisis, of the financial losses in the sector and the banking sector. But even at the beginning of the episode, I did mention that the crisis at the heart of it is a political and an institutional one. So even if we do conduct these economic recovery plans or these financial recovery plans, if we don't reform the political structure in the sense of instating good governance mechanisms, we have an anti-corruption commission that has employees but is not yet activated, and this is a conscious decision. This commission could monitor public finances. We don't have an independent judiciary to kind of look into cases of money laundering. So the reforms are there, and we have also the endowments. We have infrastructure. That's we have land. We have a human capital structure that obviously has been crippled. but we have the basic, you know, requirements to enact, you know, a clear economic political plan as a way forward.
They're saying no shortage of ideas for what might be the way forward. I want to bring up the former president of Lebanon, because he spoke at the end of October when he stood down, and he was pointing the finger at other people and a lack of progress, but he was president during that time. So I was like, hold on a minute, who's to blame here? So I just want to bring him up, because he's setting out, no, this is what we need to do as a country. Habib, bounce off the back of it, because I don't know if you have a way forward, if you see a way forward, but I'd really like to hear it. First of all, here's the former president.
You all know the conditions of the country and how its coffers were robbed, its central bank was robbed, and how your pockets were robbed. In order for the country to live, it will need reforms and should punish the influential people who paralyzed the judiciary and stopped the criminal investigation regarding the port.
So if you want to know my reaction, I mean, I think the Lebanese, I think people should know that in Lebanon, there really isn't one president. The president is one role in the country. In Lebanon, almost every mountain has a president, and we have many mountains. So the problem in the country is that it's a decentralized and fragmented country. You know, Aoun could say he wants something, somebody else doesn't want something. So they all blame each other, essentially. And it's not entirely wrong for them to blame each other, because there is no central command in the country. There's no central government. There are all these militias, all these old feudal chiefs, and again, all this foreign American, Iranian money in the country, Saudi money, that is doing that. So we can't just kind of isolate things and say, oh, this guy or that guy or this person. You can go on and on for a year. I mean, they are all militia leaders. They're all war criminals in this country. And so we can pick and choose who we want. But at the end of the day, we have to come to the realization that an international consensus must happen. It is not just the Lebanese people in a room. It is also the big countries that have to decide. Last time, we didn't have a president for 2 years. Mm-hmm. We had like 40 attempts to elect a president. None of them failed. So we're pretty early in the day right now. And what happened in the end was we had to have a kind of international pressure coming in. The last two presidents, actually, were elected through a kind of pressure and compromise between enemies and world power. So again, it's not just the ball's not just in Lebanon's court, unfortunately. And I think we have to look wider and see that we're in the context of this region, which is at a deep war and a cold war right now. There are a lot of interests at stake.
So I want to ask Alia, you the question that's actually just behind me right here. Lebanon, is change possible? That's the starting point for this conversation. Can you help us end it?
Well, change is, of course, possible. We're at the very transitional stage, and unfortunately, a lot of what will follow up in Lebanon will depend a lot on what happens in the region, and not only in the region at this stage, everywhere else in the world. But the bottom line, I think, the problem is we really are seeing, you mentioned in the introduction, we're seeing small change happening today, regardless of what we think of the 13 MPs, independent MPs in parliament, regardless of what we think of the performance. We are seeing a little bit of change in the life of the parliament. It's not big enough to show us actual what we would like to see, what we would like to see as an emergency plan to get the country out of this huge crisis that it's in. Right. Now, the big question is today, yes, it's true that we have a lot of kings or presidents, but the game, like the power breaker is Hezbollah, because as an armed party, it is compromising. Yes,
you have the last compromising word in this show other than me.
Okay.
Because I'm going to say thank you.
So then I'll go very quickly. Change is possible. It's a very, very, I think it's a very long road. What gives me hope is young people in this country and what
Alia,
we see
thank
is
you.
Being done.
Habib. Thank you, Hussein. Thank you. Passing over to the younger generation, it's in your court now. Thank you so much for watching the stream. I will see you next time. Take care, everybody.